I'm going to show you today proof of the ADL admitting that Jews stole their Israelite heritage from Christians, confirming that they are indeed the seed of Satan. I discovered this while reading a smear piece on a great Christian identity pastor named Dan Gehman. You can see it for yourself on the ADL's website. For those of you who don't know, the ADL is a Jewish organization, you probably do know that. And throughout this entire smear piece, not once did they disprove any of his claims. They attempted to discredit him by attacking his character based on association. Let me show you where they admit their lies right in front of our faces. He concludes, logically. Notice they chose the word logically themselves, so they're admitting that it's a logical claim that Jews have stolen the Christian Israelite inheritance. So by validating his beliefs, which are true, they then go on to quote him saying, "Please, dear Christian Israelites, how have the Jews managed to steal their heritage from you? What we must understand is that the Jews have good mental ability, and being guided by their father, the devil, they have managed to carefully expunge from the Bible major truths upon which they have been able to fool the world into believing that they are the true biblical Israel." And then they don't go on to deny those claims to be true. So they testify against themselves yet again, as they always do. It's right in our faces, brothers. We gotta wake up to this bullshit. Imagine a world without hate, huh? I'll tell you how we can have that, Rabbi. Grab your Torah that you just testified was stolen, and flip open Deuteronomy 7 and see for yourself what should have been done. Well, that's it for this video. Until Revelation 20:10, you serpents.
Okay, guys, so now let's go ahead and see what the Jews have to say from their own literature. Okay, this is Origin of Jews Today by their own words. Esau Edom is modern Jewry. 1925 Jewish Encyclopedia, Volume 5, page 41, not of Israel or Judah. Strictly speaking, it's incorrect to call an ancient Israelite a Jew or to call a contemporary Jew an Israelite or Hebrew. Jewish Almanac, 1980, page 3. Edomite Jews began to call themselves Hebrews and Israelites in 1860. Encyclopedia Judaica, 1971. The Jews are not Judeans, Israelites at all, and are those described in Revelation 2:9 and 3:9. So now let's go ahead and just again listen to what Henry Ford has to say about the Jews.
Henry Ford, founder of the Ford Motor Company, assembled a staff of experts to research the origin of European Jews who had been entering America in large numbers since the 1880s. Ford's research cost him several millions of dollars, and in 1923, he published the results in a four-volume work titled The International Jew. It was Henry Ford's conclusion that the Jews were not descendants of the biblical Israelites. Ford further proved that these Jews, committing all sorts of crimes while under the cover of being called chosen people of the Bible, were rapidly taking economic and political control of America. Henry Ford also claimed that the Jews had secretly gained control of most Protestant seminaries and Christian book publishing houses and had been able to remove almost all criticism of Jews from Christian literature. In summing up his findings, Henry Ford stated, "The Jews are not the chosen people, though practically the entire church has succumbed to the propaganda which declares them to be so." Ford's book caused a major uproar for a few years, but soon disappeared from colleges, universities, and public libraries, and became unobtainable at any price.
All the Jews came back close to the bottom. There's just this strange malignancy now that seems to creep among them. I know the radicalism. Very interesting thing. So few of those who engage in espionage are people. Very lucky, aren't we? As a matter of fact, very few of them become communists. But the Negroes, have you ever noticed? The grand few Negro spies.
They're not intellectual enough.
Not smart enough. It may be not smart enough to be spies. The Jews are intellectual enough. The Jews are born spies. You know somebody of them are just in it, up to their necks.
No, I've had a basic deviousness that.
Well, also an arrogance. An arrogance that's what makes us strong. He puts himself above the law. Colson discovered something. He's a clever guy. time report and that time report. I didn't hear from them. They all said it was those times.
Always been told, and didn't you believe, as I did until I was over 30 years old, I thought Jews were just a religious group. If you are a Jew, you believe in Judaism. If you abandon Judaism and deny it and become an atheist, a fanatical atheist, and attack religion, you certainly couldn't be a Jew if Jews are just a religious group, could you? This is what the Jews told me. They said there can't be no such thing as a communist Jew because Jews are a religious group, and if you become a communist, you're no longer Jew. That's what the ADL says, and I believed it. So the Jews put out a book called Who's Who in American Jewry, and who do they list? Who is his picture right here? But Leon Trotsky, and we find out his name is Bronstein, and he was a Jewish tailor from the Lower East Side of New York before he went over there to Russia to run the revolution. There's one of them. Remember the other guy we said, Litvinov? Imagine how shocked I was to discover it. Litvinov, that sounds like a good old Russian name, doesn't it? Well, it turns out that he's one of the tribe. His name is Finkelstein. Here he is, put out. Now listen, this isn't stuff from me. This is stuff from the Jews, published by the Jews as a directory of great Jews, American Jews, and they list the two leaders of Russia as American Jews. Doesn't that surprise you? It did me. Now the next one, ladies and gentlemen, here's another one. You may say, well, that was quite a while back, because that thing was published in 1939. Here's one that just came out 2 years ago. It cost me $35 to get it, but boy, was it worth it. It's called Who's Who in World Jewry. Now, this is the real authoritative list of the real top Hebrews. Let me give you the list, ladies and gentlemen, of the Jewish organizations. I can't read them all. I'll pick a few out. There's about 100 organizations listed here as the sponsors of this authoritative list. It says of the great and biographical dictionary of outstanding and noble Jews of the world. Let me give you some of the people: the American Jewish Congress, the American Jewish Committee, the American Jewish Historical Society, Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, the Hillel Foundation, I bet you got one right here, ask them. Canadian Jewish Congress, Central Conference of American Rabbis, Jewish Theological Seminary, and there's about 100 of them here. They say this is an authoritative book, a list of Jews. On page 29, ladies and gentlemen, what do we find in the authoritative list of Jews? Herbert Aptheker, the chief theoretician of the Communist Party. His daughter Bettina runs the riots on the hour and the half hour out there at Berkeley. Here, ladies and gentlemen, is the proof from their own pages, from the Jews themselves, that they consider a communist, atheist Jew as one of the tribe, as one of the boys, even though he's attacking religion. I didn't put him in there. Can you imagine a book called A Directory of Great Christians listing George Lincoln Rockwell as one of us? Or Adolf Hitler? Not yet, not for a while. You will see the day that that will be in. But right now, everybody's too scared. People are scared of these Jews, so they don't do it. But the day is going to come when we'll list our good boys in there, too. Now, before I go on from this subject of communism and Jews, I want to show you another document here. Here is a document, these little ribbons. I've left this ribbon outside of the glassine cover so you can see what it is. This one is a document obtained from the U.S. archivist, Wayne C. Grover, signed, sealed by the United States. To fake this up would be forgery. It would be a prison offense. Here is an intelligence report by your G2, by your intelligence people, right after the Russian Revolution, to the American government and to the War Department and the President as to the nature of the Russian Revolution. Remember, this is one of the documents you can get from me and study for yourself and see whether I'm misquoting it or whether it's misrepresenting. I would like to read one section here where it says the composition of the first Russian government, the commissars and the first Soviet. Here is what the intelligence report shows it was made up of. This is the government of Russia right after the revolution. It was made up of 2 Negroes, 13 Russians, 15 Chinamen, 22 Armenians, and more than 300 Jews. Does that sound like a Russian government to you? Now, in case that isn't clear enough for you, this guy who was at the time, this has been declassified, but when he wrote this, this was a classified document, so the guy let himself go a little bit. Listen to what he says. He says, it is probably unwise to say this loudly in the United States, but the Bolshevik movement is and has been since its beginning guided and controlled by Russian Jews of the greasiest type. Now, can you possibly have any doubt what the guy is saying, what he means, that this is the Russian Revolution wasn't Russian, it was Jewish? But to tell you that, ladies and gentlemen, I got to face violence and force and all sorts of insults and derogation in order to tell you, even if it's wrong, don't you think the right way to deal with this thing is in the form of a formal debate? Don't you think there ought to be a confrontation? If I'm wrong, don't you think the Anti-Defamation League or the Hillel Foundation should supply an expert so that he and I could stand before you and we both present our sides and you judge? They won't do it. They never have done it. They keep saying, we won't degrade ourselves with arguing with Rockwell. I don't wonder. When I've got documents like their own Who's Who and World Jewry, what are they going to say? That's why they tell you they wouldn't degrade themselves to come up here. They won't use the old-fashioned American method of confrontation. I accuse them, and they keep calling me names. They won't discuss the facts. All they keep doing is trying to punch me in the nose, calling me an MF-er like out front here and so forth.
There are three possible methods by which the communists might take us over. One would be by a peaceful coup d'etat, as in Czechoslovakia in 1948. The second method would be by fomenting civil war in this country and aiding the communist side with military might. But there is a third method, which they are clearly relying on most heavily. And this is taking us over by a process so gradual and insidious that communist rule is slipped over so far on the American people before they ever realize it is happening. The process in that direction is going on right now, gradually but surely, and with ever-increasing spread and speed. A part of that plan, of course, is to induce the gradual surrender of American sovereignty, piece by piece and step by step, to various international organizations, of which the United Nations is the outstanding but far from the only example. But another part is the conversion of the United States into a socialist nation, quite similar to Russia itself in its economy and political outlook, before police state enforcement is ever introduced. The best way to explain the aim here is simply to quote the directive under which some of the very largest American foundations have been secretly but visibly working for years. This directive is so to change the economic and political structure of the United States that it can be comfortably merged with Soviet Russia. Now, here are the communist aims for the United States. 1, greatly expanded government spending for every conceivable means of getting rid of ever larger sums of American money as wastefully as possible. 2, higher and then much higher taxes. Three, an increasingly unbalanced budget, despite the higher taxes. Four, wild inflation of our currency. Five, government controls of prices, wages, and materials, supposedly to combat inflation. Six, greatly increased socialistic controls over every operation of our economy and every activity of our daily lives. This is to be accompanied, naturally and automatically, by a correspondingly huge increase in the size of our bureaucracy and in both the cost and reach of our domestic government. Seven, far more centralization of power in Washington and the practical elimination of our state lines. There is a many-faceted drive at work to have our state lines eventually mean no more within the nation than our county lines do now within the states. Eight, the steady advance of federal aid to and control over our educational system, leading to complete federalization of our public education. Nine, a constant hammering into the American consciousness of the horror of modern warfare, the beauties and the absolute necessity of peace. Peace always on communist terms, of course. And 10, the consequent willingness of the American people to allow the steps of appeasement by our government, which amount to a piecemeal surrender of the rest of the free world and of the United States itself. In summary, gentlemen, we are losing, rapidly losing, a Cold War in which our freedom, our country, and our very existence are at stake. And while we don't seem to know we are losing this war, you can be sure the communists do. There is just one thing, only one thing in the whole world which the communists fear today. It is that despite their tremendous influence in our government and over all of our means of mass communication, the American people will wake up too soon to what has really been happening and what is now happening right under their very noses. The only thing which can possibly stop the communists is for the American people to learn the truth in time.
Haven't you folks always been told, and didn't you believe as I did until I was over 30 years old, I thought Jews were just a religious group. If you are a Jew, you believe in Judaism. If you abandon Judaism and deny it and become an atheist, a fanatical atheist, and attack religion, you certainly couldn't be a Jew if Jews are just a religious group, could you? This is what the Jews told me. They said there can't be no such thing as a communist Jew because Jews are a religious group, and if you become a communist, you're no longer Jew. That's what the ADL says, and I believed it. So the Jews put out a book called Who's Who in American Jewry, and who do they list who is his picture right here? But Leon Trotsky, and we find out his name is Bronstein, and he was a Jewish tailor from the Lower East Side of New York before he went over there to Russia to run the revolution. There's one of them. Remember the other guy we said, Litvinov? Imagine how shocked I was to discover it. Litvinov, that sounds like a good old Russian name, doesn't it? Well, it turns out that he's one of the tribe. His name is Finkelstein. Here he is, put out. Now listen, this isn't stuff from me. This is stuff from the Jews, published by the Jews as a directory of great Jews, American Jews, and they list the two leaders of Russia as American Jews. Doesn't that surprise you? It did me. Now the next one, ladies and gentlemen, here's another one. You may say, well, that was quite a while back, because that thing was published in 1939. Here's one that just came out 2 years ago. It cost me $35 to get it, but boy, was it worth it. It's called Who's Who in World Jewry. Now, this is the real authoritative list of the real top Hebrews. Let me give you the list, ladies and gentlemen, of the Jewish organizations. I can't read them all. I'll pick a few out. There's about 100 organizations listed here as the sponsors of this authoritative list that says of the great and biographic dictionary of outstanding and noble Jews of the world. Let me give you some of the people: the American Jewish Congress, the American Jewish Committee, the American Jewish Historical Society, Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith, the Hillel Foundation, I bet you got one right here, ask them. Canadian Jewish Congress, Central Conference of American Rabbis, Jewish Theological Seminary, and there's about 100 of them here. They say this is an authoritative book, a list of Jews. On page 29, ladies and gentlemen, what do we find in the authoritative list of Jews? Herbert Aptheker, the chief theoretician of the Communist Party, his daughter Bettina runs the riots on the hour and the half hour out there at Berkeley. Here, ladies and gentlemen, is the proof from their own pages, from the Jews themselves, that they consider a communist, atheist Jew as one of the tribe, as one of the boys, even though he's attacking religion. I didn't put him in there. Can you imagine a book called A Directory of Great Christians listing George Lincoln Rockwell as one of us? Or Adolf Hitler? Not yet, not for a while. You will see the day that that will be in, but right now everybody's too scared. People are scared of these Jews, so they don't do it. But the day is going to come when we'll list our good boys in there too. Now, before I go on from this subject of communism and Jews, I want to show you another document here. Here is a document, these little ribbons. I've left this ribbon outside of the glassine cover so you can see what it is. This one is a document obtained from the U.S. archivist, Wayne C. Grover, signed, sealed by the United States. To fake this up would be forgery. It would be a prison offense. Here is an intelligence report by your G2, by your intelligence people, right after the Russian Revolution, to the American government and to the War Department and the President as to the nature of the Russian Revolution. Remember, this is one of the documents you can get from me and study for yourself and see whether I'm misquoting it or whether it's misrepresenting. I would like to read one section here where it says the composition of the first Russian government, the commissars and the first Soviet. Here is what the intelligence report shows it was made up of. This is the government of Russia right after the revolution. It was made up of 2 Negroes, 13 Russians, 15 Chinamen, 22 Armenians, and more than 300 Jews. Does that sound like a Russian government to you? Now, in case that isn't clear enough for you, this guy who was at the time, this has been declassified, but when he wrote this, this was a classified document, so the guy let himself go a little bit. Listen to what he says. He says, it is probably unwise to say this loudly in the United States, but the Bolshevik movement is and has been since its beginning guided and controlled by Russian Jews of the greasiest type. Now, can you possibly have any doubt what the guy is saying, what he means, that this is the Russian Revolution wasn't Russian, it was Jewish? But to tell you that, ladies and gentlemen, I got to face violence and force and all sorts of insults and derogation in order to tell you, even if it's wrong, don't you think the right way to deal with this thing is in the form of a formal debate? Don't you think there ought to be a confrontation? If I'm wrong, don't you think the Anti-Defamation League or the Hillel Foundation should supply an expert so that he and I could stand before you and we both present our sides and you judge? They won't do it. They never have done it. They keep saying, we won't degrade ourselves with arguing with Rockwell. I don't wonder. When I've got documents like their own Who's Who and World Jewry, what are they going to say? That's why they tell you they wouldn't degrade themselves to come up here. They won't use the old-fashioned American method of confrontation. I accuse them, and they keep calling me names. They won't discuss the facts. All they keep doing is trying to punch me in the nose, calling me an MF-er like out front here and so forth.
So, what's up with the revolutions lately? Are they happening more frequently, or is this just how it's always been? Is a revolution just an organic response to oppression, or is there something more to it? Let's go ahead and take a quick look at some of the major players involved in several political revolutions throughout history. We'll look specifically at the Bolshevik Revolution, the Chinese Revolution, the Ugandan coup, and the Cuban Revolution, and see if it sheds some light on the question, what is a revolution? So let's look first at the financing behind the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia in 1917. In the early 1900s, Jewish banker Jacob Schiff was believed to be the richest man in America. He often spoke publicly about the role he and other Jews had played in the Bolshevik Revolution. Here are some articles from the New York Times that capture some of those public statements. In Untermyer Joins Protest En Route, Schiff states, "And thanks are due to the Jew that the Russian Revolution succeeded." And then, in Pacifists Pester Till Mayer Calls Them Traitor, Rabbi Stephen Wise boasts about a propaganda campaign in Russia that was financed by Schiff. Lenin, who rose to power in the aftermath, was partly Jewish himself, and his second-in-command, Trotsky, was also Jewish. In fact, much of the new Bolshevik leadership was Jewish, especially at the top levels. So, with that said, I tend to agree with Schiff. Without Jewish financing and leadership, it's unlikely the revolution would have been successful. But this should be familiar information for anyone who studied the Bolshevik Revolution. So let's shift east now to a revolution we probably know less about. Okay, so next we'll have a look at Mao Zedong, who rose to power in China in 1949. With him, on the far left in this photo, we have Israel Epstein. And then, beginning from the far right, we have Solomon Adler and Frank Coe. And then the woman next to Mao is Anna Louise Strong. All four are Jewish. 2 points of interest here. First, Frank Coe served in the U.S. Treasury Department and later went on to work for the International Monetary Fund. Before moving to China, Coe was called to testify before a House Committee on Un-American Activities regarding his involvement with the Communist Party USA. He pleaded the Fifth, and no further action was taken. Secondly, Polish-born Israel Epstein, a journalist and propagandist, became one of the few non-Chinese members in the Chinese Communist Party. His role in the party is murky, although he may have served in the Ministry of Appropriations, which would have been a powerful position. And then finally in this photo, we see Sidney Shapiro, a member of the Chinese People's Political Consultative Council. While the presence of Jews in the Bolshevik Revolution isn't surprising, given the large amount of Jews living in Russia, the presence of Jews in communist China is peculiar. But I suppose this could be explained by acknowledging, and it's really no secret, that Jews have been the driving force behind communism on an international level, and that Jews have a commitment to the struggles of the working class. Now, this still leaves a question about Jacob Schiff. Why would a leading capitalist banker support a communist revolution? And again, to explain this away, we only need to acknowledge that Jews regarded themselves as persecuted minorities in Tsarist Russia. Therefore, Schiff's commitment to the revolution was solely based on his commitment to liberating his own people. And these explanations are sufficient until we consider Uganda. When we look into Uganda, we find that Idi Amin had accepted Israeli and British funding for his coup in 1971. Apparently, these investors became heavily involved in the new nation because later he ended up throwing the Israelis out of Uganda because they were destroying the economy. When he expelled the Israelis, he went from hero of Uganda to psychopath in the American press overnight. In response, Time magazine ran a clear propaganda piece claiming he kept severed heads in his freezer. And we're left to wonder, what was the real purpose of such a blatant propaganda article? Was it possibly to prepare America for war against Uganda, so that the investors who had been thrown out could recoup their losses? Well, what makes this so remarkable, though, is that here we have a clear example of Jewish investors involving themselves in a revolution in a foreign country for the sole purpose of enriching themselves at the expense of the native population. And all of the excuses go out the window. We see what this has been about all along. Revolution is a business.
If I go to Israel, I used to stay with a Dayan. He brings Air Force band playing for me. We stay together. But I must make it absolutely truth. The reason why I chased them from Uganda was because of the economy of Uganda. Uganda was going to be bankrupt. That is the reason why I chased away the Israelis.
You said you were friends with Golda Meir.
Yes. I changed from Israeli alliance because Israeli are criminals.
Now that we're making progress and beginning to understand what really happens in the background of a revolution, there are a few pitfalls to be aware of. And we can observe two of those by studying Cuba, where at least one of Fidel Castro's financiers was a wealthy international Jewish businessman named Israel Ricardo Ciborana y Lobo, or just Ricardo Wolf. He's pictured here on the right with Golda Meir and Israeli president at the time, Yitzhak Ben-Zvi. After financing Castro, Dr. Wolf will go on to serve as the Cuban ambassador to Israel. And also of interest, Castro himself is of Jewish ancestry. But the first pitfall to avoid is our natural inclination to assume that if one side is financed by international businessmen, the other side must represent the good guys. And in the case of Cuba, the defending regime led by Batista was also deeply involved with international money, having close ties with Jewish mob boss Meyer Lansky. So it's safe to avoid that sort of polarized good guy, bad guy thinking. It's more revealing to identify leaders as being aligned with international elements or aligned with national elements. And as is often the case, in Cuba, both men owed allegiance to international investors. There's also one other detail that we can learn from the Cuban Revolution, and that is that the investors sometimes damage their own people. While before the Bolshevik Revolution, Russian Jews were living among the lower class, so the process of collectivization had no negative impact on them, in Cuba, Jews were already up the social ladder, and they were firmly seated in the upper middle class and above. So the transition to communism damaged the Jewish community in Cuba. As we study revolutions and become aware of the leading role of Jewish investors, it's important not to be confused by the cacophony of opinions among different Jewish groups. Bear in mind also that many of Cuba's wealthy Jews were given refuge in Miami, making it the city that it is today. We find something similar occurred under Stalin as well, where some groups felt targeted by Stalin's policies, and yet others were satisfied. One extra thought I'll just include here. The amount of control exerted on the new nation really varies. In some cases, it seems as though the financiers simply ensure that the new nation honors their bonds and remains beneath the umbrella of the International Monetary Fund. And then in other cases, we see Jewish involvement throughout the top levels of the government. And these nations appear to be under firm control. For example, this was the case in the early Soviet Union. One other pitfall to avoid is the simplistic viewpoint that internationally financed revolutions all utilize the hammer and sickle logo. While all of the revolutions mentioned so far would be labeled Marxist revolutions, there are other revolutions that don't bear that trademark name. For example, many of the Arabian dynasties we know today were put in place after the fall of the Ottoman Empire in World War I, from a conflict instigated from within by a disproportionately Jewish group known as the Young Turks. In fact, I think it's safe to say that Marxism, as a political system anyways, has grown passé in recent years, while the newer model, the democratic revolution, is in fashion. And of course, this raises questions about other governments throughout history. And we have to wonder if they were all backed by international wealth. For example, what about Gaddafi of Libya, or Assad of Syria, or Abdulaziz of Saudi Arabia and Pol Pot of Cambodia, just to name a few. So, what's gained from this ruthless business? Well, first and foremost, there's the return on capital in the form of the interest paid on the new bonds. The new nation is shackled with debt before it even begins. And this is really the tragic irony of the situation, since the nation, whether they realize it or not, likely went into revolt because of the burden of debt. And what's really sad is that any leadership among the revolution that refuses foreign aid will be crushed by those who accept it. Also gained from this business is the chance that the nation will remain open to multinational corporations. Maybe the nation offers up its natural resources or its labor. And not to be overlooked, in some cases a revolution allows for the liquidation of the existing intelligentsia, which reduces the nation's ability to threaten the global system or liberate itself. And this might actually be a greater incentive than we first realized, considering that an aristocracy is just a natural outgrowth of the best and brightest of the body of a nation, the cream of the crop, so to speak. So without an aristocracy, a nation has no real memory and lacks the leadership to defend itself. So let's go ahead and wrap up now by putting our research into the context of a larger timeline. How did all of this come about? How did we get from European colonialism to a state of permanent revolution? Well, colonialism can roughly be broken up into three pieces: the East, Africa, and the Americas. In the East, in China and India, there was the opium trade. In Africa, there was the diamond business. And then in the Americas, the slave trade, to name just a few. Our history books like to teach us that these enterprises were driven by European nation-states, and to some extent they were. However, behind many colonial operations, it should come as no surprise now, we find someone who is Jewish, like the Sassoon family, who monopolized the opium trade in the East, or, as we see in this list, demonstrating the Jewish monopoly over the American slave trade. Just a quick side note here. A history professor named Tony Martin, who's probably one of the world's leading experts on the history of slavery, has tried to bring this information to light, only to meet insurmountable pressure from various Jewish groups like Hillel and the Anti-Defamation League. Impressively, Jewish groups like these have used the legal system and political correctness to effectively rewrite the history of Western civilization. In any case, another example can be seen in colonial Africa, where we do find the presence of a non-Jewish businessman now named Cecil Rhodes, but according to Jewish author Edward Epstein in his book The Rise and Fall of Diamonds, if we look behind Cecil Rhodes, we discover that he was financed by N.M. Rothschild & Sons, an elite Jewish banking dynasty. In fact, if we were to look behind all of these men, we would likely find various Jewish banking dynasties. The old colonial system was unsustainable, though. It probably required too much police work. So it didn't take long for our international plutocrats to devise a new system that was both sustainable and more cost-efficient. And that new system is the revolution business, which we believe might be more appropriately named neo-colonialism. Thanks for watching.